You are listening to a sermon recorded in 2007 at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, thank you very much, Evan, for that warm welcome, and I hope I can live up to at least some of it. I'd like to start with a formal greeting to all who share membership in the body of Christ. And I hope by the end of my reflections this morning, the context, or at least one of the contributors to that formulation, will be a little more familiar to you. I hope, too, that the readings, which were so thoughtfully read here this morning, will become a little more familiar as you hear them in the life of the person I will speak about. But as I was listening to the first reading, it's uncanny. It's the same reading that is being read in the Catholic Church just down the road this morning. And so there is a fellowship between our communities, hopefully reflected in that greeting form that I said at the beginning. Greetings to all who share in the membership of the body of Christ. I spend my academic time working primarily with 4th-century Christian texts. And one of the interesting developments in the last generation of scholarship has been a return to a body of texts that had been overlooked for some time. And this body of texts are lives, biographies of famous Christians. And from the period of the mid-350s to 397, there are 6 very good biographies, very strong biographies. There are also 2 autobiographies in the same period, including the very famous and well-known Confessions by St. Augustine. Of the biographies, perhaps the most well-known and certainly the most popular comes from the late 390s. It's the life of Martin of Tours. And the figure himself, Martin, is an attractive figure. He's a simple man who came up from the army, the Roman army. His father was in the army. He reluctantly was forced to join the army. And he identifies with the experience of people who have suffered that kind of lifestyle. And he has emerged subsequently as the patron of anybody who's had to serve in military uniform. He probably had little or no education, a very simple man, but a man of very profound faith that drove him or encouraged him to do interesting things. And one of the most well-known events was when he was a soldier, he ran across a beggar who was freezing, and he cut his military cloak in half and gave it to the beggar. A story enshrined in all kinds of stories, stained glass windows. It's one of the signature features of Martin. Why scholars have been interested in him more recently, or is the fact that in Martin's career, he became an ascetic, became a monk, then became a bishop of Tours, and the life shed some light on how he conducted himself as a monk and bishop. And something new is happening. He developed an interest or a mission for the people beyond the cities and beyond the towns of France. He went into the rural districts to deal and encounter people working the land, simple folk with no education, still caught in the practices of various religious practices of the rural regions. And he had a particular affinity for these people and a certain urgency to extend the Christian mission beyond the cities, beyond the educated classes. That has interested scholars for a while, long while. But something new has entered their interests in the last, it's 10 years exactly. An article was published in 1997 on the life of Martin. And there's an interesting sub-theme going on, and that's what I'd like to focus on. The sub-theme in the text, there are a couple episodes in which Martin is represented as at odds with his fellow bishops in France, or they're at odds with him. And that's an interesting theme, which I'd like to develop a little bit. There's one episode when the people want him to be their bishop in Tours, and the neighboring bishops come to consecrate him, and they're somewhat reluctant because he's uneducated, he's slovenly dressed, and unkempt. This is the description that they have of him. He becomes bishop nevertheless. Martin, for his part, isn't very flattering towards them, and he accuses them of being too preoccupied with wealth and status. Particularly status at the imperial court at Trier, which was an imperial residence at the time, that they would spend too much of their time courting favor with the emperor and the bureaucracy, enjoying banquets and festivals there. And Martin publicly criticized them for this and embarrassed them over it. Well, lurking in the background is an episode, a very painful episode in the 380s, there was an ascetical movement. Remember, Martin is an ascetic, a monk, and that's the key to the issue I'm trying to develop. There was an ascetical movement going on in Spain as well. And again, the educated bishops got uneasy with this kind of new movement that is emerging in the 4th century. And they persecuted this movement. In fact, much to Martin's horror, they got permission from the imperial court to put the members to death. This was the Priscillian movement in Spain. Martin was horrified at this, and he really lashed out against his fellow bishops and had very little to do with them after that fact. So what's emerging is a tension in the late 4th century, at least in France and Spain, and there's evidence elsewhere, between two models of the Christian life. The model represented by the new ascetical movement that is going to emerge into monasticism, which is very penitential. Celibacy is very much part of their lifestyle. And there are variations on this theme, but it kind of a disregard or a distrust of any natural desire, any natural experience, and any bodily activity, that it was looked upon as somehow beneath the dignity of the Christian. So they had this negative evaluation of that side of life. They also tended to have a negative evaluation of public culture, public education, and they would tend, even people who had gone to these kinds of schools would turn their back on it and just repudiate it, sometimes publicly. So that's the kind of attitude that many of them, not all of them, but many of them represent. Well, in the life of Martin, there's one exception. One of these other bishops, who is not a monk, or not an ascetic, a very educated figure, is named in the life of Martin with real respect and honor. Hilary of Poitiers, a bishop in southern France near Bordeaux. Hilary, years when Martin was very young, had tried to recruit him to ministry in the Diocese of Poitiers. And Martin backed out of that offer. He wanted to be a simple monk and live on his own rather than get involved in an urban church. He was to be dragged more or less into it at Tours a few years later. But Hilary is treated with respect. He's not lumped in with the other kind of upper educated class of elite leadership in the Christian church, the bishops. Now, Hilary is interesting because he has written an autobiography. His autobiography is very short, and from a human interest point of view, not very exciting. It's written exactly 40 years before Augustine's much more exciting Confessions. And part of my academic interest this summer is to try to illustrate that Augustine, in fact, had read what Hilary had written. Hilary wrote this autobiography, and very brief, it's 16 paragraphs in the main, so it's not long. And he wrote it to be book one of his 12 books on the Trinity. And it's not, it's inserted there not just out of human interest so that you get to know the author. He's got a thesis that he's trying to argue. And his claim that the issue in his day that's under attack, what is the relationship of Jesus, the Son, to the Father, is not just a theological issue, but it really strikes at the fundamental Christian hope. What's available for the Christian, particularly after death? And so Hilary became a staunch defender of the full equality of the Son with the Father in order to guarantee a substance for the Christian hope. And so he writes his autobiography as a way to set up the argument. And I'd like to talk about that autobiography with you. He presents himself as an adult. He's an adult convert. So it's a conversion story in many ways. And he represents himself as somebody who comes from an urban culture, a highly educated culture. And he starts off by not repudiating his past, the resources that he learned at school. And he's very much shaped by the rhetorical tradition of Cicero, and the philosophical essays of Cicero are very much at work in the way he presents himself. And so he's talking about this journey towards the fullness of Christian faith. And the first stage is not a repudiation, but rather a recognition that even in that public culture, there are elements that can become, with God's help, stepping stones to advance further in the faith. And he points out that in public culture, there is a basic aspiration among the people of his class to live a life of leisure. Now, that's not laziness. That's a culture that is leisure and financial security. And that's to provide opportunity for reading, for discussion, for conversation, for writing. That's what Cicero would mean by it. That's what Hilary means by it. And he says, this is the first aspiration that we share. But he says, we've got to go further than that. And he has some rather amusing comments on the limitations of that as the ultimate ideal. And he said, people who get involved in this advance to the next stage, which is, what about ethics? What about morality? Can that help us expand our horizons and deepen our sense of what it is to be human and responsible humans? And he finds that element in his public culture as well. And the third element he finds there is interesting. He says, and he uses this term, there's a natural instinct if we only look in. If we only listen to ourselves, within every human being, there's a natural instinct for God, an openness for God. And he says, even in Cicero and other authors of our public curriculum, you can see signs of that. And he says, there is a sense that God, there is a divine who exists. And there are various names for that, and some of them tend to be on monotheists, some are polytheists. And he looks at this somewhat critically. The issue there that really does bother him is within Roman culture, there seems to be an option. God exists, the divine exists in some form, but is this God provident? There is a very famous school of thought in Roman philosophy that said the gods exist, but out there in the far distant realms, they have not the slightest interest in human affairs. So the existence of God, but no providence. On the other hand, Stoicism is very strong on providence, that there is this divine coordinating principle in the universe and in society that exercises care. So Hilary observes, well, there is this general providence, but what about care for me and care for you? That's not there. So then he says, there's no I or ego in this autobiography. It's very interesting. It's just the mind. He's trying to use his own experience as a mirror for everybody to find their own path through this journey. So he says the mind gets anxious and gets agitated that these aren't sufficient to answer the quest of the human heart. And he says he plots a sequence of steps. And actually there are three biblical readings, including the two that we had here this morning. And it starts with the passage in Exodus. And he's fascinated by it. And he gets really excited by that, especially the name. I am who I am. God exists. And God exists as a source of my existence and our existence. And he finds that a really liberating, exciting notion. But he says, after he thinks about that, after he thought about that, he's still not satisfied. Because he remembers from his Roman culture, they believed in the existence of God. But what about God's care for us? What about providence? And then he selects three texts, which are not in our service today. Three texts, two from Isaiah and one from Psalm 137. In one of those passages, it's simply, God says, I hold the world in my palm. God holds us all in his hand. And there he finds confidence in God's care and providence for each and every one of us. And that is a major step. That's step two for him. So from existence to providence. But then he pauses and he said, I'm still very concerned. And he says, I can understand the possibility of immortality of the soul, a very common theme in Roman culture, Roman philosophical culture. What about my body? He really specifically says, what's its future? It's me. It's part of me. What's its future? And then that's when John's prologue comes into play. And he quotes it at length. And he highlights verse 1 and verse 14. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was God. The Word was with God. And then the other verse he highlights is 14, and the Word became flesh. That divine Word taking on human flesh is central to his conversion story. That in the Word becoming flesh, God has become one with us. And he's taking the word flesh, the Latin word corpus, in two senses. The individual Jesus Christ, his individual body. But he also sees corpus as a very social, the body politic, if you like, in Cicero. And so in that Johannine expression, the Word became flesh, yes, as an individual, but yes, as extended to everybody who shares human flesh. There is this union between God and humanity. And that is the goal, the passage that resolves Hilary's quest, Jesus Christ is God, fully equal with the Father. Jesus Christ has become flesh and sharing his life with us. That's more or less the conclusion of his autobiography. But then he goes on. I got one more episode. And he goes on in book two to talk about that Johannine passage. It's really a commentary on the first 14 verses of John. Halfway through, something surprising happens. He says, I'm sitting there reading this, and all of a sudden somebody shows up beside me and starts talking to me. And he says, I've never seen this person before. And what's more, he's smelly. He's a fisherman covered with mud. And he returns to that description, that physical description, a couple times in roughly 10 paragraphs in which this encounter takes place. And this smelly fisherman says, Hilary, you're being too philosophical, too speculative. The Word was God, and that Word was is the eternal present, the fisherman says. He doesn't explain himself, he just says. This means God is, was, and will be eternally. And with, he says, that means something about the relationship, the permanent relationship of Word and God, with. And then the last one is took on human flesh And he describes, as I've just presented it, it's not just the individual flesh, but all of us together. At the end, John never names this visitor, but just before the visitor disappears, he says, "This was the one who at the Last Supper sat beside the Lord and laid his head on the breast of the Lord." Clearly a reference to John. So this is the life of Hilary, very unlike all the other lives and autobiographies. There are six lives and one other autobiography of the last part of the fourth century. This alone is one written by somebody who was not a member or not involved in or not interested in the ascetical tradition. This is the other voice, the other experience of leadership, which at the end of the fourth century is in tension with what is emerging and what is going to become the paradigm of leadership in the church in the West for the early Middle Ages. They're going to be bishop monks. Hilary wasn't. And I think he has something interesting to say. I come back to my greeting. Greetings to all who share in the glorified body of Christ. Now I add that, glorified this time. That's Hilary's understanding of what it means to be Christian, that already we're participating in the dying body, the risen body, but he says already we're participating in the glorified body of Christ. So I'll leave his greeting with you.